Hi everyone, welcome to Finding You in Vogue Therapy podcast. Today we have the pleasure to welcome Ashley Warner to the podcast. Ashley is a holistic family psychologist, and today she's going to be teaching us about emotional regulation and co-regulation. So I'm very grateful to have Ashley with us today on the podcast. Thank you for joining us today, Ashley.
Thanks for having me, Brad. It's great to be here.
You know, when we talked in preparation, we're going to talk about emotional regulation. But I want to begin kind of with your background and how you got into this work and to where you are today and to what you're doing.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there's probably two things that guided me to this work. I'm trained as both a psychologist and a family therapist. And before I had my own kids, I was working in trauma, an area of trauma with women and children who'd experienced both sexual and family violence. And I felt like the work that we were doing in that area was really profound. And I felt like the things that we were teaching those families to help their kids recover from that trauma was huge. And I just wished that we kind of weren't waiting until something went wrong or something was really significant to get this information out to families. And so there was this kind of idea in my head that I thought every parent needs to know this. It's not just when trauma happens, when big T trauma happens. I really felt like these were skills and knowledge that I wish that all parents could have. So that was kind of the first thing that was brewing as I was working professionally. And then also, I guess, you know, what we kind of perceive was missing from our own childhoods tends to be what drives our highest values. So for me, I guess there was a perception that emotions weren't really understood or weren't really accepted in some ways in my family, despite having grown up in a very loving and very beautiful family home. There was just this lack of understanding about difficult emotions. And as a sensitive kid, I guess that really had an impact on me and how I kind of stored and understood and processed my own feelings, which I understood as an adult when I started to do my own work. So it was kind of both of those things that drove me to where I am today. And so now I guess I work with parents around helping them understand the importance of emotional regulation and the importance of being with difficult emotions, the importance of accepting emotions, and really helping parents kind of, I guess the buzzword now is re-parent themselves or relearn or unpack their conditioning around what they experienced when they were little and maybe what might be a different way of doing it now.
Your approach and method, your ideas mesh so well with those that our audience are going to be used to. Well, I know this might be a difficult question to ask, but kind of to simplify, what's the message that you're hoping that people get from your work if they could hear one thing?
Oh, one thing. That is hard. Right. I guess probably the most important thing and one of the biggest things that I'm really trying to advocate is that for healing and unpacking and relearning things is not just for people who've experienced that big T trauma. So it's really, I think, anytime anybody steps onto the path of parenting, we also really need to step onto that path of healing as well. And so I guess my work is really helping people understand that. That's probably the number one, if I had to pick one.
I love what you say about emotional regulation and when you talk about co-regulation. Can you expand on that a little bit and tell our audience what you mean when you're talking about supporting children in their emotional regulation?
So I guess children and teenagers, I know your audience probably has a lot of teenagers. So young children's brains are very underdeveloped, and same with teenagers. They're going through kind of a reconstruction phase in their brain. So we often expect them to have more ability to regulate their emotions on their own and to self-soothe than they are actually capable of doing. And co-regulation is really about, you know, every moment that we're having an emotional exchange with somebody, we're co-regulating. Our nervous systems are feeding off each other. They're talking to each other. So when we're with our children, it's really important that we understand that in those moments, we're building those memories and those experiences and building their brain to understand how to manage and how to deal with that emotion. So for example, every time I'm sitting in a space with my child and he's having it might be a difficult emotional, you know, positive emotion, we're kind of communicating with each other, and I'm helping him build the foundations that will then later go on to support him to be able to self-soothe when he's old enough, when his brain's developed, and when he's on his own and he needs to. So they're kind of borrowing our calm, borrowing our prefrontal cortex, and we become that kind of lighthouse in their storm that shows them the way, shows them how to get there.
I was looking over your website and your Instagram, and there was I don't know where I saw this video of you describing what you just described. You talked about words, you know, parents, people that are asking for phrases, words, kind of scripts to use with their children. And then you talk about, and I think it's along this line of what you're talking about with co-regulation, you talk about being with the child in a certain kind of way. And I think that's a very powerful way of, it doesn't tell somebody what to do in a given moment, but I think it's a very powerful idea that you talk about there. Can you say more about that how the children kind of absorb our anger, our anxiety, how our regulation affects them and their nervous system?
Yes, I think that we so desperately all want to do a good job as parents. That's, you know, obviously such an important role that we have. And with that desperation and with that, you know, wanting to do so well, we tend to just want somebody to tell us, what do I say in the moment? What do I do in the moment? And everybody and every nervous system is so unique that I don't think these scripts really work. I think what actually, because so much of it is about authenticity. And so while the scripts and you know, the words can be helpful when we're trying things on and when we're working through things, it is authenticity, and our kids can feel that and they can sense that in their nervous systems. Because when we're not authentic, it's actually a threat to the nervous system. So it's going to increase stress in the child, because a child, they're looking to us. They're looking to us to understand, you know, is this okay? What does this mean? They're feeding off of us. So the first thing is that the reason why I think this is really important is because of that idea of authenticity. It's that idea that we need to do this from within, not just, you know, copying what somebody's told us. And then I guess that kind of brings us back to that idea that, you know, just as I said before, that the healing that we do within is what really makes the change when we're being with our child in the moment. And when we can sit with that emotion within ourselves, when we've learnt to sit with that anger or to feel that sadness or that grief, then that means when we show up with our child, then we have kind of a deeper knowing of how to do that. And it doesn't matter exactly what we say, and it doesn't matter what the phrase is, but it's a really authentic response that means that we can then sit with our child's pain, and they start to get that, and they start to understand, oh, this is how I do it. They can feel the mood and the tension that we have. I think I mentioned this, but the nervous system reacts to or absorbs what's going on in the other nervous system in the room. And that's, you know, a survival mechanism. We need to be able to do that. We need to be able to read what's happening in our tribe. So our children unconsciously absorb what's going on, and they unconsciously absorb how we respond to our emotions. So if we, for example, you know, often I give an example of myself, my tendency is to blame others when I'm feeling discomfort. So instead of feeling into that discomfort, instead of holding it and really being with it, my tendency is to want to blame everybody else, because that puts it outwards, and then I don't have to feel that real discomfort. And so I'm really mindful of working through that, so that my children, because if I do that over and over and over again, as my children are young and as we're in our home, then what they learn is that that's just the way you are with discomfort. They can start to absorb that and take that on. Oh, this is how we respond to emotions. So a big part of my work is learning how to be aware of that pain pattern and to choose a different response.
I don't know if this next question even makes sense, but you mentioned earlier that much of our audience, it tends to be focused on parenting teens and some young adults, although some of our audience don't have children at all, but that is a large focus. And so I just can't help but ask this question, because of your accent, which I love. I love the Australian accent more than any accent in the world. I'm wondering how much exposure you have to American culture. And if you see some, is it pretty much the same? Because American culture is not uniform anyway. We have the South, the Northeast, the Midwest, the West, right? We have all different kinds of cultures here. Are there differences and similarities that you would that jump out to you when you think about Australian culture, Australian parenting, and American culture and American parenting?
Yes, I do work with a lot of American clients. So, and I would say that the challenges that we have, and I can't distinguish exactly where they're from or the differences within America. I definitely don't have the knowledge or understanding of that. But I would say that the parents I work from, you know, from the Middle East to America to Australia, we're all kind of having the same challenges, and we're all trying to learn similar things. We're all coming from backgrounds where maybe a generation ago emotions weren't really accepted. And so the body memories within ourselves are that we dismissed, deny, distract. Culture often says that we should ignore tantrums or that kind of thing. And so I find that parents, wherever I work with them around the world, are still trying to find out, how do I come back home? How do I relearn? How do I understand how to sit with emotions? And it seems quite similar to me.
Right.
Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
I was interested if there was something, because I find whenever I'm talking to folks from around the world that you can point out some small differences, but we hold more in common than we do differences. So I'm just curious about that. I've heard you just mentioned tantrums, and I read again when I was researching you some comments somewhere where you talked about how tantrums or tears, rage, can be a good thing. Tell us a little bit about that, the purpose that they serve.
So I think so many of us are kind of conditioned to believe that our parenting, if our child has difficult emotions, particularly in the earlier years, if they're having tantrums, that it has some kind of reflection on who we are as parents, that it's almost a bad thing. And that if our two-year-old's having tantrums, that, you know, we've done something wrong. And I think that often parents who, in our culture particularly, parents who have children who don't have tantrums often wear it as a badge of honor. And so that's something I'm really trying to get out there as a shift in the message, is that actually tantrums are a really healthy thing, and crying is a really healthy thing. And I'll, you know, talk specifically about little kids, because I think that's when tantrums are most common and we most understand them, but obviously we all have tantrums in our own way, even as adults. Is that getting those, emotion is just energy. It's energy in our body. And so we need to shift that energy. We need to move it. And tears can be a really healthy way to do that. And there's been some really interesting studies. I can't off the top of my head think of who it was, but I know there was a study done where they researched the components of tears, and they found that the stress hormones were actually being released out of the tears when people watch sad movies, versus the components within the tears when they cut onions, for example, weren't the same. And so I always like to tell parents that, and to talk to them about, you know, when your child's crying, they're releasing those hurts. They're releasing that built up stress from the day or the weeks earlier. And if we can reframe that and readjust that to be a healthy thing from those early years, we can start to teach children that, you know, that tears and those, that sadness and that discomfort, it's not something to be afraid of. It's not something that, you know, stays forever. It's a process that we move through, and it feels uncomfortable and it's difficult and it's hard. But when we move through that emotion, then we process it and it leaves the body, and then we can kind of get on with our day. And I think anybody who's sat with a toddler, who's really sat with their emotion and allow them to have that big tantrum and that big cry or that big rage, then what you often see is they just go, oh, okay, I'm better now. And then they can just move on. And I think that that's it's a huge lesson to learn. If we could have this repeated over and over again when children are little, or even as teenagers, that they can move into that discomfort with a loving presence of another person, they can really learn that, you know, this stuff doesn't stay around forever. This will pass. Because I think as a culture, I know in Australia, that kind of saying gets thrown around all the time, this too shall pass. But most of us don't have any memories of what that actually means in our body. We don't have any real knowing that actually if I move into my discomfort, it will rise and rise and intensify and then it will dissipate. But I think if we sit with our kids through that and hold their hand through that, then they'll have that knowing. And that means when they're older and there's other ways that they may be tempted to move to avoid their emotions, they won't need to.
I mean, I think it kind of goes to this next question that I had, which is the consequences if we don't, if we're not able to, unwilling either to hold space with our children, what are the effects on them and their development?
Well, of course, like anything, we can never be 100% sure because every child and every person is completely different. But I guess what we see when we work with adults who have had that experience, and I know for myself especially as well, but also the adult clients that I work with, is that what tends to happen is that we develop these beliefs around emotions. We develop these ideas or core beliefs, as often they're termed, about how it's unsafe or how maybe other people can't handle my pain or it's not safe for me to feel this or I'm too much. And then when we have those core beliefs, then we're going to react to those in some way. If that's the story that we're holding about pain and discomfort and difficult emotions, then we're going to react to that to some way. We're going to try and avoid that in some way. And so, you know, there could be a whole range of things that people do, but it probably means that they're less likely to reach into connection and relationship in order to regulate, and they're more likely to do something like, you know, avoid it or deny it or maybe take drugs, or I don't want to say, you know, drugs is the definite path, but I guess it's just one example of what might happen when we can't learn to sit with that discomfort.
You know, I'm going to, before we end today, I'll ask you where people can find your work, but this next question, maybe this is part of the workshops that you hold, and it kind of goes against what I was asking earlier in a way. Specific recommendations that you have for parents about how to hold space for their children? How do we raise children who are capable of having a healthy relationship with their emotions?
And I guess that is kind of what we've just been talking about, isn't it? It's really about learning, first of all, learning to sit with your own emotions, because what we can't sit with what is in our child with unless we've sat with it within ourselves. So we can't sit with our child's anger unless we can be with that part of ourselves that expresses and experiences anger. So the first part of that, of learning how to hold space for our kids' emotions, is learning how to hold space for our own emotions. And when I say hold space, I know that's a bit of a term that people often say, what are you talking about? What do you mean? And I guess the way I describe that is that we're in the presence of another person who is having a difficult emotion, and we want to have one foot in our own body and one foot in their body. If we're too much in their experience, then especially as parents, we can get really empathic and we can find it really difficult, and we might want to stop it or fix it or rescue them from that experience. If we're too much in our own body, then we're bringing our own experiences and our own lived experiences and our own memories of that emotion or that experience that our child's happening. So we need to kind of balance that. And that's why I try and talk to parents about having a foot in our body and a foot in their body, so that we can feel what's going on with ourselves and regulate ourselves. Because if we're starting to get overwhelmed, or it's reminding us of a time when, you know, we were a child, for example, and we were left out of a school group or a friendship group, then our body might start to feel overwhelmed, and then we're no longer their lighthouse in the storm. So we need to be regulating ourselves as we sit there and empathize and connect with our child. So that's kind of the most important, I guess, foundational piece, is that we're regulating and we're present and we're authentic, because that's showing them what to do. What I often talk to parents about is that we don't have to actually teach our child what to do in the moment. So, you know, especially if a kid's having a really big emotion, for example, I say to parents, don't ever say, like, maybe you should take some deep breaths. All we need to do in that moment is take deep breaths ourselves. So if they're having a difficult moment, we can just take a deep breath or feel our feet on the floor. And because our nervous systems are so beautifully communicating with each other, they will pick up on that. And they will start to learn that that's the way that we do it. And they may not copy us in that moment, or they may not do it in that exact moment, but just modeling it and just doing it for ourselves is a huge part of the learning of their learning of how to react in that moment.
What you just said reminds me of what took me, I don't know, 15 years in my marriage to realize that when I thought my wife needed a timeout, I needed a timeout.
I love that. Yes. That just reminds me of a concept I teach in my work with parents called the setup, and where children will often, and, you know, some people have don't necessarily like the word setup because it sounds manipulative, and I don't at all mean it manipulative, but children will often set us up to feel the way that they're feeling, so that we can understand and so that they can watch us respond. So often, you know, for example, in my work, parents are feeling, I just feel powerless and I just feel frustrated all the time. Okay, so let's have a think about, is there a chance that that's what your child's feeling? And often that tuning into their own experience and tuning into that, you know, for example, powerlessness helps them recognize, oh, this is actually what my kid's experiencing. And then in that moment, how are you dealing with that powerlessness or that frustration? Because your kid is unconsciously watching. And so then we need to be really aware of how we're dealing with that difficult emotion. Because if they are, you know, setting us up to feel that, then they're also watching how we deal with it. So I just wanted to add that in there because that sounds exactly like what you were.
Yeah. I love that so, so much. You, I love also how you kind of just weave in very, very subtly about how it's a struggle for all of us, you know, for you, for everybody. And so I love that compassion. My question about this is, you make a really passionate invitation, gentle invitation for parents to do their own work. And so I'm sure, like a lot of us, you run up against resistance, right? Parents that want to make it about the child, that want to focus on the child's problems. And so tell me what you think, how would you describe the resistance that you commonly come up against with parents, and how do you help them to kind of overcome or move through that resistance and dive into their own work?
Well, I'm kind of lucky now with what I do because people tend to only come to me when they want to do their own work. So I've kind of shifted that. But more traditionally and in other work that I've done, and I guess, no, that's not true. There are definitely times when I do get clients that, that feel like it is about their child. I guess it really is about starting with compassion, and it's about starting with understanding that it feels scary to go into our own work, because probably we talk about trying to give our children those experiences of moving into discomfort so that they know it will pass. Probably they haven't had that experience of, and so the idea of moving into their own work feels overwhelming and scary. And I don't want to say easier because that sounds dismissive, but it feels, you know, the brain will only show us what we can, or the body will only show us what we're ready to heal. So sometimes parents, I guess, are saying, oh, it's about my child, because they're not quite ready to move into that themselves yet, into their own within themselves. So I think it really starts with compassion and understanding about how hard it is to do the work. But then I guess, you know, parents are coming to me because they're pretty stuck, right? They're coming to me because they're at their point where they're like, I don't know what to do anymore. And often they've tried all of those rewards, consequences, punishments, and they keep hitting the same brick walls. So once we start with compassion and understanding and helping parents understand that your body will only ever go as far as you are capable of. So while it feels scary, it feels hard, it's a step-by-step approach, and we're not going to just, you know, dive into anything really big. I think that, you know, that generally, and that, I guess, that desperation of wanting to have their family back, of wanting to have things go well, of wanting to have that experience of a family that they always dreamed of. Because most of us grew up thinking, oh, when I'm parents, I'm going to do it differently. And when I'm a parent, I'm going to have this loving, happy home. And I think also just helping them understand that children are designed to press our buttons. They're actually, close human relationships are there for growth. And so when we're in the presence of another person, they are there to help us see which parts of ourselves we need to heal. So it's kind of this beautiful dynamic that occurs within a family where it is a struggle and it is difficult and it isn't always peace, because it is about growth.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think when I help them see all of those pictures, and with a bit of their, you know, well, I've tried everything else and nothing else is working, and just a lot of compassion and a lot of understanding that diving into our own feelings and our own discomfort is really hard. And also just reminding them that this isn't about blame. Relationships are not about blame. It's about a dynamic, and it's about, you know, taking responsibility, but responsibility is not the same as blame.
Right.
I think all of those things can really help them kind of move into their own work a bit more.
I don't know if you're familiar with Joseph Campbell at all.
No, I'm not. But I love hearing these, so I will write that down and dive into him.
He's an American philosopher. He studied myth. And he looked at all religions, myths, and stories, and he said there's really just one story. And he indicated a moment in every heroic journey that you kind of just referenced, which is, it's that moment when you're at the bottom, when all is lost, when you've bloodied in battle and you're ready to surrender, and that's the moment that the wizard appears. That's the moment that the magical helper appears. So I imagine you serve that for parents in the way that you work is that you're at that point where they're, like you say, they're ready to ask the question and try something different. And that's so hard for us to think and do something different than the way that we were taught to think and how we were taught to behave. So I see that being a nice, because we use that pattern in our program. We actually have the students in our program read a story called The Knight in Rusty Armor, where, you know, just before the Merlin appears, he's ready to give up hope on his life. And that's when Merlin showed up. I relate to it for sure.
Oh, wow. I like that story.
Tell me about the broken cookie moment that you talk about in your work.
So the broken cookie moment is this idea that I think is really important for parents to understand, because the broken cookie moment is that idea that, you know, the child cries because the cookie's broken and they wanted one whole cookie. And the cookie's broken. Even though it's still a cookie, they burst into tears over the cookie. And I think in kind of mainstream parenting or current mainstream culture, we often dismiss that, or, you know, we see that as a sign of weakness, or that children aren't resilient, or there's a lot of judgment made about that. But actually, that's kind of the wisdom in the child's body of waiting to the moment till it's safe, and waiting to the moment until their parents might be, you know, they might be with somebody that they feel safe with, like their parents, to release all of that pent up hurts or stress or stuff that's been going on for them. And so they use that moment to release the tears and to release the frustration. And so I guess I always like to talk to parents about that so that they can reframe that. So instead of thinking, oh my goodness, my child, you know, I don't know if this is an American phrase or an Australian phrase, but often in Australia, children often called a sook, which is this idea that they're, you know, they're not able to be strong and resilient. But actually what's happening in these moments is they're rebalancing their nervous system. They're getting the tears and the stress out so that then they can move on with their day. And I think we all have broken cookie moments. I had one with my husband last week, and I can't remember what it was. It was so minor, and I just cried and cried and cried. And then I went, oh, this has got nothing to do with that. This needed to come out. I'd been holding it together. And this was the moment that he and I were alone without our kids, and I could just let it all out. So I think even as adults, we do have those broken cookie moments. And as parents, I really hope that we can reframe them and go, okay, it's not about the cookie. You just need a moment. Let's sit down. Let's be with this feeling.
I won't go into it, but you just spoke to my heart. I had a broken cookie moment. I didn't know exactly how to frame it that way with my youngest of four last night. And you gave me a great comfort in your story and your example and your teaching. So thank you. I'm glad we had this conversation today.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad.
What can parents do? Obviously, we're going to be triggered. So what can we do as parents with our triggers? And what does it actually mean for a parent to use their triggers as a teacher? You talk about that.
So I think the first thing is to understand, and I think I briefly mentioned this earlier, but to understand that children are supposed to trigger us. This is part of the dynamic. They are supposed to, you know, I guess in our wisdom, in our body's wisdom, we avoid certain things, or we, you know, we don't want to dive into something. And that all makes sense. We can't dive into everything. We can't feel every emotion. We can't heal every wound. So what happens is our body, you know, stores things, but we kind of avoid it in our conscious mind. And once we're a parent, we realize that we can no longer avoid things because our children will show us the parts of ourselves that we are yet to heal. They will show us the next part of us that we are ready to dive into and to move through. And so I guess the first thing I love parents to understand about this is that you are not a bad parent if you get triggered. Your child is just showing you the next thing that you can heal, and you will never get through. You will never get to a point of healing where you're in this perfect, happy family bubble where you never get triggered, because that's just not the way it works. So I first really like to normalize them and to help parents understand that it is shining a light on something inside of our body that we are yet to heal, but it is normal and it is expected, and we can never avoid these moments. So that's probably the first part that I think is really important. Once we kind of reframe them and we understand that, okay, this is, my husband and I always have a joke that depending on how intense the trigger is, if it's, you know, too intense, we're not going to do this. But sometimes he just whispers to me and says, divine gift, divine gift. Always makes me laugh, because I think, yes, triggers are, you know, sometimes known as divine gifts because they do give us a new opportunity to respond in a different way, which gives us an opportunity to heal whatever it is that's been brought up from the past. And they don't feel like divine gifts in the moment, but they, and, you know, my husband particularly does this when my child's whinging, because whinging is something that, I don't know, I think you use the word whining in America. I've just worked this out recently. Whinging is not something you use. Whining, I think, is the term. Mm-hmm. And it's something that really grates on my nervous system. So he always just whispers, divine gift. And so in those moments, I have an opportunity, probably because when I was whining as a child, it was probably responded to with maybe some harshness or some frustration or some dismissing. So there's probably a lot of body memories for me around that.
Right.
So then the work is about, how do I respond differently now? How do I kind of honor that part of myself that didn't get what I needed earlier and give that to myself? And how do I make a different response now? So that's, yeah, so I guess we're trying to use them as teachers and as ways to heal the parts of ourselves that are coming up for us. And, you know, a bit more practically than that, I guess it's just about trying to increase the pause between the moment that something happens and our response, because really we want to try and work towards responding rather than reacting. And the best way we can do that is by increasing that tiny little moment between when our child does something and when we respond. And, you know, there's lots of ways that we can do that, and I think it's different for everybody. But one of the things that I often talk to parents about, all the things that I think is probably most important and yet so simple, is simplifying our lives. I think we're so busy and we're rushing around and we're moving from A to B and we're trying to get kids into I don't know about America, but especially in Australia, from activity to activity. And it's really hard for us to increase that tiny little space and to be able to respond rather than react when we're constantly rushing and our nervous system constantly, you know, got adrenaline pumping because we've got to get to that next thing and we've got to be somewhere. So you know, just at a very basic level, I say to parents, the first thing we can do is simplify our lives, simplify our schedules, especially given I tend to work with parents who are at home with young children. Just simplifying those days so that we have space to be able to become aware of the way that we're responding rather than just moving from one thing to the next.
Yeah, we don't know anything in America about the stress of scheduling at all and all of the pressures on us. So we'll try to understand what it's like for you guys.
And I guess the other thing that I try and talk to parents about too is using those moments to really say out loud what you're doing, because those are not only beautiful moments of teaching for yourself and relearning for yourself, but it's also a really beautiful moment when you're triggered to be able to teach your child how to manage a really uncomfortable feeling. And so I often say to parents, just be authentic. Don't try and pretend that you're feeling fine if you're not, because they can feel it in their nervous system. So speak out loud what it is that you're doing. You might just say, wow, I'm feeling really out of control. I just need to go to the kitchen and get a glass of water. Or, you know, I'm feeling really angry right now. I'm just going to, and whatever you need to do. But saying that out loud and owning that is a really, for a start, it's de-stressing for the child, because they're like, okay, mum's angry, but she's got it. Versus I can sense something in my nervous system, but mum's pretending like everything's fine, or she's smashing dishes or whatever. So really just speaking out loud, owning the feeling, and then saying out loud what your regulation strategy is can be hugely important for children in that moment as well.
I love that shift from trying to control what you're feeling to learn how to move through the feeling, be with the feeling, own the feeling. That's really helpful.
Mm.
Ashley, I'd like to read, if it's okay, a couple of quotes from you.
Sure.
And just ask you to, if you can or are able to, kind of expand on them a little bit. I have a couple. One that I really liked, and then one that when I was looking for you was quoted and shared by many people. So the first one is one that I was really drawn to just myself, where it says, responsive parenting does not cause anxiety in children, but responding with anxiety can. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so I think that we have such a fear around, like, again, I don't know if this is an Australia term, but like mollycoddling. Do you have that in America or something similar?
Yes, I think I know what it means.
So it's kind of like when we're overprotecting, and we, like, it almost is like wrapping kids up in cotton wool balls. And so cotton wool. And so that kind of idea of overprotecting children has been moved on to responsive parenting. And so when people engage in kind of or practice, you know, attachment parenting or responding to kids' emotions or responding to kids' needs, there's a real cultural narrative around you're going to make your child weak. They're not going to have any resilience. They're going to be anxious all the time because you haven't let them live anything. And I guess what I'm trying to differentiate there is that responding to needs is not what causes the anxiety. It's if we respond to the needs in panic, in stress, that's what can cause the anxiety in children. So if your child falls over, for example, and you respond in a calm way and you go over there and you say, wow, I saw that. That looked like it really hurt. And you give them a cuddle. That's very different from running over and going, oh my gosh, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. And so you can respond with calm and regulation and compassion and empathy without causing a problem. But it's the panic within your own system that I would say is more likely to lead to anxiety than the responding itself.
I lied. I want to insert another question before I ask the final. You say, if a child doesn't respond to our verbal request, then information is not what they needed. Tell us what you mean by that.
So I think, you know, we all do this as parents, don't we? We repeat something over and over again and we wonder why our child's not listening. And I guess what I'm trying to advocate for in that moment is that repeating the same thing is not helping. So it's just a cue for us, a red flag to go, okay, well, they didn't need information. That's not, they didn't need a verbal request. So I think in that example, I was probably talking about young children. So maybe, for example, you know, like telling a young child not to hit the dog. So I think in that example, I was talking about, you know, something like a young child not hitting the dog, but it can be used in lots of different circumstances, is that the verbal request is only one way to teach something to a child. And potentially if their nervous system's completely out of balance, if they're dysregulated, then they may not be able to hear that, or they may not be able to take that on board. Or if they're young or they're a teenager and they're having difficulty with impulse control, they may just not be able to control their body at that moment. So repeating it over and over again is not necessarily what it is. So it might be an emotional regulation strategy that they need. They might need help coming back online in their body. They might need rebalancing before they can kind of hear anything or follow any instructions. Or they might need more connection. They might need more compassion and empathy. They might need, so there's a whole bunch of things. Like I talk about in my work, the six pillars of conscious discipline. And, you know, so I never remember them when I repeat them, but, you know, relationship is really important, emotional regulation, boundaries, us healing, that's another one. But the point is there's lots of different ways that we can help a child feel disciplined in their life. And just talking to them is only one small part of that picture.
This is the quote that when I was looking at your information, this is the one that people seem to resonate with. I know I resonated with it. And it says it so clearly. I don't even know if there's anything to add, but I'll read it out loud because it's profound and simple and straight to the point. You say, beneath every behavior, there's a feeling. And beneath each feeling, there's a need. And when we meet that need, rather than focus on the behavior, we begin to deal with the cause, not the symptom.
I wrote that when, after reflecting on the ideas of behaviorism that we use with children, and which really just came out of research with rats and mice. So it's something that I have a lot to say about, I guess, is that we're not rats and mice, and that we are, our children's behavior is a reflection of something deeper. And that when we just focus on that behavior, it's like those little, you know, you bop down one thing and then the other thing bops up again, and then you bop down something else. If we're not actually focusing on the root cause, then we're just forever chasing our tails. And the behavior is never the root cause. The behavior is always just the symptom. It's the guiding thing that shows us there's an issue or something going on. But it's not the whole story. As humans, we're always driven by emotions and feelings, and the behavior is just that surface part. That's like the tip of the iceberg, but there's so much more going on beneath the iceberg. And so I wrote that, yes, with a bit of a response to, let's stop kind of focusing on the behavior and let's work underneath that in a bit more of a holistic way, so that our kids can get their needs met and their feelings regulated, and then those behavioral symptoms will be less intense and pop up less.
Yeah. I find not only with our parents, but sometimes the therapists that work in our program, I have to remind them of that also, because very easily when you're working with teens to become focused on the behavior, because the behavior is effectively loud and distracting.
Yes. Yes.
So a couple of last questions, Ashley. Ask my last questions. I want to make sure to give you the chance to share with people where to go to find out about your work. Maybe even you might mention what kind of online offerings you have, where to look for social media. So tell people where to find you.
So mostly I'm probably most active on Instagram at raisinghumanskind.com. And also my website is holisticfamilypsychologist.com. And I offer, at the moment, I have a course for parents of children of 1 to 6 on emotional regulation and conscious discipline. And I'm just about to open a private Facebook group for that. I'm not sure when this will air, but I think I haven't exactly set the dates, but sometime probably February or March, I'll open a private Facebook for anybody who's purchased the course, because I think what happens is we often buy courses, or online courses a great way to learn, but I really also like the opportunity to be able to ask questions and dive into personal examples and scenarios. So I'll open for anybody who's purchased that since I opened the last one, I'll open a 6-week private Facebook group where we can kind of dive into the work together and dive into some personal examples and scenarios that that feels relevant for each of those families. So that's a great way to work with me. And I'm actually at home with my little one at the moment, so I'm not doing any online therapy, but normally I do work with parents all over the world doing coaching and self kind of healing work so that they can be the parents that they want to be.
Wonderful. Thank you. And the last question I like to ask our guests is, what do you do for self-care? How do you take care of yourself being a mother? Your family obviously has needs, and also you're a professional who is serving clients in various capacities. How do you practice? What are your practices for self-care that keep you filled up so you have something to offer those that you care about and serve?
I like this question. I love that you ask everybody this. Well, there's a few obvious ones. Like I surf at the moment. It's summer here. So I go out surfing, which is being in the ocean and being by myself in the water on my board is a beautiful way to kind of fill myself up again. And my husband and I always prioritize that time for ourselves as a family. So we think that looking after ourselves and nourishing ourselves means that we can be better parents. So we always, at the moment, it's a little bit easier because he's on holidays, but we give each other some time in the day to do something for ourselves, which means that we can come back to the family feeling refreshed and ready to be better parents, I think. But outside of those bigger kind of ticket items that are a bit more obvious, I think the best way that I take care of myself is with boundaries. And so it's the little moment by moment things that I do when I'm home with my kids all day, for example, and when my toddler sleeps, I have a really clear boundary around not doing any kind of housework or any chores. I don't get things done. I just choose to do something that nourishes me. It might be read a book. It might be have a cup of tea. It might be eat a little bit of chocolate without him. And I've still got my other child with me, but it just means that, you know, I'd set aside some space while he's resting for me to rest as well. And those boundaries have become probably the most important part of, and that's just one example, there's other examples, but that's probably the most important way that I've learned to look after myself, because it's not always easy as a parent to go surfing or do something like that. You have to also learn how to look after yourself within the context of the family home and with your kids next to you, and showing them how you do that. So showing them that I sit on the couch and have a cup of tea and take a rest, for example, I think is really important to model that they also deserve to say no when they need to and take care of themselves when they need to.
Ashley, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I think it's a wonderful, beautiful perspective that you have, and also for parents of younger children, but I think it applies to virtually all of our relationships. And thank you for, like I said earlier, that something you said to spoke to my dilemma, my situation last night and this morning. So I really appreciate you coming on, taking the time and sharing with us your wisdom from your experience.
Thank you, Brad. It's been wonderful to chat to you and to share this message. And I really appreciate you having me on here. Better year you'll be.